Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Hi, this is Bill. Welcome to this week's episode of Real World Fitness. We have an excellent interview for you today, but it's also a long one. So we're going to get right to it after we pay homage to our sponsor, like we always do, audible.com, for a free trial membership, which entitles you to one free book. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Serotalk. There are a lot of really great books there, as well as recordings of old radio shows and all kinds of really cool stuff, including some books authored by some of my guests, like Josh Hillis and Dan John. So once again, that's audiblepodcast.com/Serotalk for a free 1 month trial and one free downloadable book. My guest today is a true bodybuilding legend. He's also a former New York Jets football player and also a retired school teacher. It's an interesting mix of things. He's won numerous contests, Mr. America, Mr. Universe, Mr. World. He was the co-star of the movie Pumping Iron, the bodybuilding documentary in the 70s that started the career, pretty much, of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Also, he is the first really big guy I ever saw in person. And just briefly, I'm going to just kind of say that I saw him in person when I was about 17, and I was just in awe. I'd never seen anything as massive and just impressive. And to top it all off, he's one of the nicest people you'd ever want to meet. My guest today, Mike Katz.
Nice to be with your audience, Bill. Great talking with you, and hopefully I can live up to that wonderful introduction.
You definitely can. Just to refresh your memory, I know you don't remember because you meet a lot of people. We've met maybe four or five times in Peter Potter's gym down here in Florida and at the screening of Pumping Iron in 1977 or 78 when Peter brought you down here. And I was afraid to talk to you. You were sitting three seats away from me and I just kept looking at you. And I think you figured out I was sitting there staring at you and you finally started talking to me, but I was just totally in awe of you.
Well, that's very flattering and it's really my pleasure to know you, Bill.
Thanks very much. Now, Mike, you and I kind of have some similarities in common. We and a lot of my listeners as well. We're not the average kid. We didn't grow up as the cool kids. We both, I think, had weight problems when we were kids and didn't really fit in. So how did you discover bodybuilding, weight training, and you know, what was it like for you growing up, and how did you first get started lifting weights?
Bill, it's a great question. I had a movie theater that was not far from my house, and we used to go on the weekends. And, you know, there was a Hercules movie. I really didn't know what it was about, but it was the Saturday movie, and the kids would go. This is back in the 50s. And, you know, Steve Reeves was the star of the film, and, you know, he's got chains in this gladiator-type movie, and he's pulling down buildings, and you know, he's just got a beautiful body. I'd never seen a body like that before because I never really was following bodybuilding or any of the magazines from either Weider or Hoffman. So this was my first exposure to a really well-built person, like crazy well-built. And not liking myself as the viewers saw when I was young, being fat and Jewish and cross-eyed and rusty fenders on my bicycle, as I said in the movie Pumping Iron, I said, maybe this is the way, you know, to get to feel. I don't think I was rationally thinking that way. I just walked out of the film. I said, if he could do this, you know, I got to try this. And a guy next door to me, who I was friends with his son, he gave me a set of weights, and I bought a coursework from Weider, and I think Clarence Ross was on the posters of how to do the different exercises, and I tried to put together a little gym in my basement. This was the, you know, the mid-50s. And off I went to trying to do the best I could, from the pictures to copying how to do the exercises, and I started getting bigger and stronger, and that's the beginning.
Well, back then you didn't go to Sears and get a weight bench and a machine and everything else. So I'm guessing in addition to that little weight set, you kind of just scrounged things up or made things for your little home gym?
Yeah, back in the day, I know that the milk crates now are made out of sort of a red plastic or blue. Back in the day, they were wood, the big milk crates. And, you know, I kind of borrowed a couple of them from someone, and I got a piece of wood that was like 2x12 wide. So it was wide enough to be sort of like a bench for bench pressing. And, you know, there was nothing else. I couldn't put a lap machine in my basement or anything like that. I was too young to understand pulleys. Because if I did, I would have gotten some garage pulleys and wire and try to put a lat pull down. So that was really in the real primitive stages of just doing squats and curls and some dumbbell work, where, you know, it's really amazing, Bill, when I think about it, how primitive it was, but how much improvement I made, even without all of the sophistication, which was very little. This was prior to Nautilus or really any sophisticated weight training machines that we have today, and we don't even think twice about it. It was sort of like a Model T Ford, you know, compared to a hybrid car today. It was that technology. But, you know, I did make improvement, but I knew that I couldn't do it alone. And I knew and heard about this guy in Meriden, Connecticut, at a YMCA, because that's really, there was no gyms then. If you worked out, you either did it in your basement or a garage, or you did it like in Pumping Iron in the garage with the coach in the movie where I trained. That was much more sophisticated.
I want to make one real good point here to everyone that's listening that does work out. You didn't have squat racks. So you were cleaning the bar, pressing it overhead, and then doing your squats that way, right?
Yeah, there was no squat racks. That's a good point. But, you know, it's interesting how, Bill, you know, you made improvement by cleaning the weight, bringing it to your chest, then popping it over behind your back. I mean, you were using a lot of different muscle groups. In a way, just getting set to do it was kind of involving a lot of muscle groups that Olympic weightlifting and even powerlifting do. So without really knowing it, just to try to squat, you were using a whole bunch of good muscle and getting development. Problem sometimes was that you'd get tired, you know, from squatting, and then all of a sudden you kind of couldn't get the bar back off and up over your head because you'd have to do sort of a behind-the-neck press. So there were
right.
a few occasions where, you know, I couldn't do it, and you just had to drop it from behind your neck and hope that it didn't hit your legs or break anything. So it was kind of, as I said, it was, you know, going down a bumpy road like in a Model T Ford in the turn of the century. We did the best we could, but, you know, it's interesting. You know, and I know I'm kind of getting off of the fact, but I mean, you go back to Sandow and Gremick and guys back in the 40s and 30s, and you looked at the marvelous physiques that they had. It's amazing that, you know, you can kind of get a real good physique and not use real sophisticated equipment. Barbells and dumbbells is where it all started.
Well, your story of how you began is not an exception to the rule. It seems to be the rule. You know, I interviewed Bill Pearl, and he started out pretty much the same way. And Dave Draper, I mean, you know, he bought a set of weights from somebody and just made it up as he went along. And, you know, all the real greats, the guys that did excel in the 50s and the 60s before we had all the high-tech crap that you don't even need, kind of started out the same way, it seems like.
Well, if you were going to drive a car, you know, back, as I said, because I'm almost as much involved in street rod, hot rod, you know, antique cars, so I kind of analogize a lot. I mean, back in the day, you know, if you were going to drive a car, you had a Stanley Steamer or you had a Model T Ford, and you just did the best that you could. Now, you know, obviously, rich people could have afforded a Duesenberg or a Cadillac, but, you know, the regular blue-collar worker back in the day, like I would have been a blue-collar worker as a bodybuilder, you know, we did the best that we could with what we had and what we learned. And, you know, reading the magazines, either whether it was Strength and Health or whether it was Muscle and Fitness, those kinds of things were sort of the Bible back then of the most highly technical things that Gremick or the Olympic weightlifters would have been doing. And you kind of copied what they had done, and then people became, obviously, from a standpoint of capitalism and entrepreneurial, abilities, then along came, you know, Nautilus, and just trying to think of the fellow that invented the Nautilus. But things got more sophisticated back in the 60s. But, you know, this, we're talking about the 50s, so used a lot of the Yankee ingenuity along the way and creativeness. And, you know, we got pretty darn good for the little amount of technology there was with either nutrition or weights.
It was more about just wanting it. So you started to say you were hearing about the YMCA and you knew you couldn't do it all on your own. So the next step was to go to the Y.
Yeah, I had heard of this guy named Joe LaPorte, and he was like the best bodybuilder back in the day of Joe Abenda, who's a little older than I am, probably 5 or 6 years. Joe Abenda was an AAU Mr. America, and he was like Vern Weaver and that group of people in that generation. And he was good friends with a guy who became friends of mine and sort of my mentor, Joe LaPorte from Meriden, which is about maybe 16, 17 miles from where I lived in Hamden. And I knew that I had to get to that Y if I was ever going to get any good, because I realized I didn't have all the answers. So I would hitchhike, and in the day, you know, you hardly see anybody hitchhiking. Well, back in the 50s, you did. You know, you didn't have the criminal issues that you'd have today doing it. And the police were reasonable with it as well, not arresting you for doing it. So I get out in the major road and hitchhike up to the Y 4 days a week and hitchhike back in the dark, and was lucky enough to have people kind enough to, you know, stop and bring me up there, and learned so much from Joe. And then there was contests. They all were held at the Y back in the day. And took me, I think, 3 or 4 years before I even could place in the top three. I think it was probably 16 or 17 years old, and I finally got good enough to start placing. But, you know, obviously was discouraged, but the discouragement led to encouragement, because I wasn't going to fail. I think that's that way with most people who have had success in anything. They just don't quit. You just have got that stick-to-itiveness of continuing to try, and whether you can climb the mountain or not, you try again, and you try again until either you die trying it or you succeed.
Okay. One point here real quick I want to make to everybody out there. How many kids, because I guess we're talking about you were about 14, 15 when you went to the Y, how many kids out there would be willing to figure out how they were going to go someplace that was almost 20 miles away 4 days a week and find their way there, whether it be hitchhiking or whatever? It wasn't right next door. It wasn't convenient. This again shows how much you wanted it. When you were competing in these, I'm guessing they were like teenage shows and that kind of thing, that was the era when there was weightlifting as part of a competition, correct? At least in the AAU competitions.
Yeah, the AAU ran the whole thing, and they were mostly weightlifters, and it was part of the Olympics, which it still is. And they kind of would tolerate bodybuilding, because at the end of the weightlifting event, sometimes 12 o'clock in the evening, would be the bodybuilding event, and you'd get a handful of people watching weightlifting, but the people really wanted to come in and see the bodybuilding event, so they'd have to pay to get in. And the monies that at that time, the AAU Amateur Athletic Union, they kind of controlled a lot of sports, including weightlifting and bodybuilding. You know, we made the money, the bodybuilders, for the weightlifters to continue. But there was a lot of disrespect. They kind of laughed at us, the weightlifters, and, you know, here's a bunch of guys, you know, walking around and posing in these little briefs, and they're not that strong, and we're stronger. But they needed us to be able to get the audience to pay the money so that there would even be a weightlifting event. And the events were late at night, and they were underneath a basketball. So what they would do on a basketball rim is they would tie an outdoor light and secure it to the rim of a basket in the gym, and they'd have a little raised platform, like maybe 4x4. You really couldn't move on the platform. It was like just enough to be able to turn around without falling off of it. And there you'd have your typical bodybuilding event. Your parents would, unfortunately, unfortunately have to put up with being there till 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. But that was the beginning of, and again, there was shows back in the 50s or 40s even, I'm sure, with the historically, with when the first bodybuilding contest appeared. But that's, you know, when you don't have anything else, it's not like, I taught school for 35 years and I've got young grandchildren and I'm not one of these old guys that looks back and tries to brag about the way it was, you know, when Poppy was a kid and you kids have got it made and you're privileged. I don't do that. I mean, kids today, it is what it is. We had it tougher, and then it's probably our fault, Bill, that we didn't a lot of times make it tougher on our own kids because we thought that making it easier would be a kinder thing to do, when really the toughness that we grew up in would have not hurt the kids of today to not feel that everything is in front of them and they don't have to work for anything, because, you know, that's not fair either. Kids today who become successful, many of them do like us years ago. They do go to the ends of the world. Their parents second mortgage their house. They move their daughter, who's a gymnast, to a different state. They go to a different school. The parents have got loans, you know, so that their kid one day might be an Olympian. So there is still a lot of sacrifice that people make, and whether it's swimming or, like, my granddaughters are equestrian horseback riders, the amount of money it takes to do that and dedication, and the kids are going there at 6 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, it's not that my generation or prior generations were any more or less dedicated. We did what we had to do, and the kids today, you know, they've got a different set of society to deal with. And if anything, you know, I think the kids who are successful today in one way have it even more difficult, because when I was a kid, you didn't have a whole lot. I mean, you had a 12-inch television set. There was no computers. There was no other way to sort of have fun unless you climbed a tree in your backyard, or that you played sandlot football or baseball, or that you did very simple things. There's so many things today that can take kids' minds off of climbing the mountain that I climbed, or trying to be a great equestrian horseback rider like my oldest granddaughter, Kylie. So, you know, I do admire kids with all of the different drug issues and alcohol issues and pressures. I think the successful kids today might have even had it more difficult because of distractions of just life in general. My day, you know, it was simple.
That's an interesting way of looking at it, and it's a very valid point. But let's talk about Mike. Let's stay focused on Mike. So you obviously were getting in better shape. You were getting big. You were getting strong. And somewhere in there, I guess you started being a little more popular at school. You ended up on the football team and so forth, right? So that kind of got you more into the, more away from not being one of the popular kids, I would assume.
Well, I agree. It was all about the feelings of being in control. Instead of the kids being in control of making fun of me, it was more about me taking charge of accomplishing things that would create respect and make me feel better about myself. So as I started to get my name in the paper, whether it was football or bodybuilding or hockey, you know, I started to create a feeling of, hey, you know, I'm not ugly and I'm not fat and I'm not somebody that should be picked on anymore, and I'm not going to let anybody do that. Sports, for me, you know, gave me that outlet to create a positive feeling about myself, and many of the successes that I've attained throughout the years, whether it's educational or athletic or from a business standpoint, all came from the time that I was a little kid, started lifting weights and making improvements, and then feeling better about myself so that I could tackle other issues as well.
Well, obviously, you were a good football player because you ended up in the NFL. When you went to college, were you a scholarshiped athlete?
I had scholarships to go to college, but I wasn't really ready to leave home. So instead of going to Richmond University or Boston College or West Point, I kind of just was not ready to leave home and the support that I had from my parents. So I went to Southern Connecticut State College, which is at the time a teacher's college. And after my schooling in junior high school, I had a teacher named Mr. Gerosa, who was my health education teacher, and I admired him. He was a Marine, and he straightened me out as a young, wise guy kind of kid. And I said, you know, I want to be just like Mr. Gerosa. I want to be a health education teacher, and I want to help kids and coach kids. And so, you know, I wasn't ready to go away to school. So to answer the question, no, the state schools, even today, Southern, most state schools, unless they're the big universities, don't give scholarships. So it was very inexpensive.
But you had the offers.
I had a lot of offers, yet I declined the offers to play Division One. We had guys in the American and Canadian Football League, so my college at the time was like a small college powerhouse, and I knew that if I went there that I would be trained well enough and coached well enough by great coaches like Jess Dow, who's in the College Hall of Fame as a coach, that I would have an opportunity to develop as a professional football player.
So your eye was on, that was the prize all along. You wanted to be a pro football player, and then the backup plan was to be a teacher?
To be Mr. America, but I knew that, I only had a small window to be a professional football player that, like Ed Corney didn't really begin until he was in his late 30s or 40s to become a great bodybuilder, and I knew that I had a lot of time after football to attempt to try to be Mr. America, so I needed to do the professional football part of it first, which I did.
You were very fortunate to be able to do that. Now, in one of your other interviews, you mentioned playing against Ernie Ladd. Now, I'm a big wrestling fan. I have a lot of friends in that industry, and I had the good fortune of meeting Ernie and interviewing him shortly before he died a few years ago. Was he really that crazy on the field?
Ernie Ladd was way ahead of his time in reference to being a well-conditioned 330 or 40-pound, 6'8" football player. I mean, the guards today, the position I played with the New York Jets, I was maybe 270, and I was extremely fast. I was fast enough to be a running back. But that same position, you know, guys today aren't 6'1", 270. They're usually 6'5", 320. So, I mean, everybody's gotten bigger and faster, and Ernie Ladd was way bigger than anybody else in football. I mean, it was very rare to see Merlin Olsen. There's a few guys who were 6'3", 6'4", you know, 300 pounds, but Ernie Ladd was feared. At that time, it was the American Football League with the Houston Oilers, and he was somebody that you would dream about at night having to play against, because I saw him once. We had a guard in the Jets named Sam DeLuca. He was a great, great football player. He does the color for, I think, NBC for the Jet game still. And he turned around his helmet, so the face mask of the helmet was facing the back of his head instead of in the position it was supposed to be. And I think he lifted him up and threw him like a sack of potatoes. And I go, oh, my God, you know, this is what you're up against is people like this playing football, and it was a good thing that there was only one Ernie Ladd playing.
Well, there were actually back in your era in the 60s, there were a lot of guys who played pro ball that wrestled in the off season, because I think back then the wrestlers were actually making bigger money than the football players. Bob Windham,
yeah.
Ed McDaniel. I think, did you play with Ed McDaniel at the Jets?
He was before me, but I know, obviously, I know the name. I think they called him Wahoo because they made believe he was an Indian.
Yeah, that was the gimmick he wrestled as.
Right. Yeah, he was a little bit before me.
Just curiosity, did you ever give any thought to going in that direction? Because there was, you know, guys Ernie Ladd.
Outside of New Haven, and back in the day, the wrestlers would, there was two or three parts of the country. So the wrestlers then weren't flying to locations like they do today. Back in the 60s, they would be in one part of the country, and then that whole group of entertainers and athletes would go to the south or to the west coast. So our area was, you know, Springfield, Mass, Boston, New York, New Haven, Connecticut, Portland, Maine. They would take a van And they, all of them, many of them, like Tony Garea, who was once tag team champion and is still one of my best friends, and he lived right in Hamden. And matter of fact, I coached his two boys who played football at Rutgers after they went to Hamden High School. So to make a long story short, many of the wrestlers, the Wild Samoans, Ivan Putski, Superfly Jimmy Snuka, actually rented an apartment from my best friend. They all lived in the New Haven area, and they trained prior to Planet Fitness. We were a world gym, and all the wrestlers, even Hulk Hogan, would, when they came into town, they would come to our gym to train before their matches. And I had a chance with Vince McMahon Jr., the son, to go into professional wrestling, but I decided not to live on the road and live out of a suitcase. I was educated to be a teacher and would rather have stayed home bringing my children up and trying to be a world champion bodybuilder than a wrestler.
It's safer, too.
Yeah, it is. They, you know, people say that, you know, wrestling is like a gimmick and it's sort of choreographed, but all I can tell you is, you know, you get in that ring, it's like playing football with no equipment on, with 300-400-pound guys. So, you know, anybody that doesn't think that many parts of wrestling are real, then they ought to get in the ring, or which I know they wouldn't, because they'd be in for a surprise. It's a lot of guys get hurt and end their careers in the wrestling ring just as they do on a football field. So I have a lot of admiration for the athleticism and strength that these wrestlers have, and many were great Olympic wrestlers and also great college wrestlers before they went into pro wrestling.
See, that's nice to hear. That's somebody who was not actually in the industry who respects the guys. That's real nice to hear. Let's go back to the bodybuilding. I'm going to hit you with two questions because I got a feeling one's going to just lead into the other rather than interrupt you.
Sure thing.
What was the first title that you actually won? And as you worked your way up the ranks, why did you go to the IFBB instead of the AAU?
The first title that I won for the first question was Teenage Mr. Connecticut, and that was probably in 59. I'm just trying to make sure the year. I graduated high school in 62, so it was, and I have the trophy. It's just, it's kind of like buried behind some of the other ones. I think it was like 59 or 60 that I won the Teenage Mr. Connecticut contest. And then there was the nickname for Connecticut is the Nutmeg State. And then I won Mr. Nutmeg State and then went on to win regional shows like Mr. New England. But a lot of them at the very beginning were AAU because, as I said in, earlier in the interview, that it was a York, Pennsylvania-controlled series of competitions. And then as I got a little bit older in maybe the late 60s, I started to understand that the bodybuilders weren't really given a fair shake. As an example, you know, Harold Poole, who at the time was for Sergio Oliva, I mean, they couldn't win the AAU Mr. America. And I think it's correct to say that the reason they didn't win is because they weren't white. And I think if you look at any of the pictures...
That's correct.
Yeah, and I think if you look at any of the pictures of anybody that knows anything about the history of bodybuilding, it was like, okay, you know, I'm not going to get a fair shake in the AAU because it's rigged for white guys. Now, okay, that may say I'm white. Why didn't I, if I had an advantage and I could beat somebody like Sergio, like Vern Weaver did, and Harold Poole got beat, which was a joke. These two gentlemen, were one was Cuban and one was probably Spanish and a mixture of black. And I said, you know what, I'm Jewish with a Jewish last name, and they're going to find a way to give me the business. So I've always sided, you know, like, and always considered myself to be the underdog or the minority. And if you bother a black or a Hispanic, then you're bothering me. And if you don't like them, you're going to find me next that you don't like, or an Italian or somebody else that you want to pick on. So I said, you know, this organization isn't for me. Even though I'm white, I don't care. I'm going to go to the best organization that's not prejudiced, and that was WEDR. And that's why I made my move from there. Also, I can remember a guy named Rudy Sablo. I have very bad memories of him and Morris Weisbrot, who were basically Olympic weightlifting AAU officials. They were like the top guys. And I remember him screaming at me. I think it was Morris or Rudy Sablo. They screamed at me, "You can't be an amateur bodybuilder. You're a professional football player. You're not allowed to go into contest." I mean, that left an indelible mark of the disrespect that those two men showed to me in reference to just being cruel and also being unfair. What's football have to do with bodybuilding? But the rules, I guess, were that if you were a pro in any other sport, you couldn't compete as an amateur. So it is what it is. Turn the page, move on. Weider welcomed me with open arms, and all of my great successes were with the IFBB, and which what now is the NPC, which is the amateur division of the International Federation of Bodybuilders.
Okay. That's interesting, because the pro-amateur thing has always been controversial. Going, wasn't it all the way back to, wasn't it Jim Thorpe who had his gold medals taken away when they found out he had played a little pro baseball at some point?
It's possible
many years behind.
Those things happened, but it wasn't even so much, Bill, the rules, you know. And I understand if, you know, that was the rule, then I'm not trying to change the rule. It's just between me seeing, you know, Harold Poole and Freddie Ortiz and Sergio Oliva, and I'm continuing to see these minorities being really screwed, being gypped of their due respect. I just said, you know what, this isn't for me. I felt bad enough as a Jewish kid growing up to have people call me a kike and a Jew boy and whatever. I'm not dealing with an organization, even though I'm white, I'm not dealing with it. I'm still feeling the sting of prejudice that was being shown back there. So that was the last straw. That was the last show I ever went in. And I was done with, at that time, which was the AAU. I was finished with them. And as I said, Weider was open his arms to everyone.
Well, you were for sure one of the most impressive guys on stage in whatever show you went to. And Weider, as you say, Weider, I mean, let's go back to what you said, Sergio and Vern Weaver. That's a joke. Vern Weaver at his absolute best couldn't touch Sergio at his absolute worst.
Sergio didn't have any weak body parts, but if he had a weak body part, which he didn't, Sergio Oliva was what a cartoon character of the day. I mean, when you look at the unbelievable development of the current bodybuilders, which you look and say, that's not attainable, this is impossible for anybody to look like this. Well, you go back like 40 years, and that's Sergio Oliva, back in the day of probably little or no performance-enhancing substances. This is just a genetic freak, like Secretariat would be as a racehorse, winning by 35 lengths at the Belmont. And here you've got Sergio, was that good, and he can't beat a guy like Vern Weaver, who was trying to become an actor like Clark Gable back in the day. It was so laughable. I said, this isn't for me. And and shame on the AAU for that true history that we're talking about right now. Shame on them. But it is what it is, and we got to move on.
Absolutely. And you were very successful with the Weider organization. Did you ever feel like you were unfairly judged there? Because we know bodybuilding judging is so subjective. Did you ever, not for sour grapes, but is there any decisions in your competitive career that you really felt like you didn't deserve?
Well, you know, all in all, my respect for Joe and Ben Weider and the opportunities that I had to be in the right place at the right time with the filming of Pumping Iron and my involvement with Arnold Schwarzenegger was made by Joe Weider, who wanted me to go from Connecticut to California and train with Arnold. So I have nothing but great things to say about my career, and I really don't look at much back except the incident in Pumping Iron where they played a trick on me and stole my T-shirt. That actually, in the end, made me a more popular, more sympathized person. But in the day, it was stinging and hurtful. It took me years to get over it. But in reference to the question, is the only contest was when they were picking the team to go to Italy for the Mr. Universe, and they had a contest, or it was a, not sure if it was an actual contest, it must have been, but they were going to try to pick the team, and I competed against Ferrigno and Arnold in the movie Pumping Iron. It was Ferrigno against Arnold, and that's the way they kind of wanted it. And this particular show, I was in the best shape of my life, and this was the way in which they were going to pick the universe team to go to Italy, like a boxer being in shape or out of shape. Ferrigno wasn't in shape, and I was. So in boxing, I would have beat him. Like many times, athletes aren't in great shape and they lose a race, whether it's track and field or whether it's boxing or whether it's whatever. But, you know, they wanted, they meaning whoever in the organization, you know, just wanted Ferrigno to go to Italy to go into the universe. And regardless of the shape that he was in, it wasn't going to matter. And I can remember Arnold in a Sports Illustrated article, because we were covered back in the day in Sports Illustrated as a, you know, legitimate sport to be covered. And Arnold said, I have the article, Arnold said that, you know, 3 weeks after the show, that Ferrigno would have beat me, meaning that the day of the show, I was better. Now, whether I was better because he wasn't in shape and I was, or whether if we were both in the best shape, maybe Ferrigno beats me. You know, I don't have any problem dealing with who's better than me. I mean, I can go down a list and you can say, okay, who do you think is better than you? And I'll give you the whole list. And if you start comparing me with anybody, I can tell you who I think is better. I'm not egotistical like that. But that day, he wasn't in shape. So he beats me. And Arnold says, if it was 3 weeks later when Ferrigno was in shape, he would have beat Katz. Well, hello, it's not 3 weeks later, and you're quoted as in the magazine that I really should have beat him. So shame on Ferrigno for not getting in shape. Would he have beat me if he was in his best shape? Probably, yes, but he wasn't in his shape. So, you know, that was stinging that I didn't go to Italy because I had always wanted to be Mr. Universe, and I, in that day and age, I had won my height division in the Mr. Universe, the tall class. I won it in Baghdad, Iraq, when Ed Corney beat me by a slim margin for the overall. But after a while, they never had overall Mr. Universes. They just had height or weight division universe champions. But in that time, I wanted to be the overall Mr. Universe, and that was taken away from me by not being able to go to Italy. So that was kind of stinging because I knew I was better. There's contests that have been close. I think the contest, like when I beat Waller in Mr. World, he wasn't in his best shape. So then, you know, he comes back and he beats me. It's sort of like Fraser and Ali. He beat me, I beat him. He beat me, I beat him. And when I finally competed my last time in the Mr. Olympia, I think it was 81, I didn't care where I placed. I went in drug-free. I took a drug test before the show. Nobody else did because that was my thing. I wanted to be proved that I was drug-free, went into an unlimited contest where there was no drug testing. I didn't care where I placed. I wanted to stand on the stage of Mr. Olympia competitors, drug-free. And I looked great, and I beat Waller. And then I retired. So, you know, to me, the last laugh, I got back on him, and I didn't care that I was 12th or 13th. I wasn't in the running. But I love the condition I was in, and if people look at those pictures of the last time I competed, I think most people would agree that I had a believable physique. I was drug-free, wasn't as pumped up, wasn't as unnatural-looking, and I'm very proud of those pictures and very, very proud of the condition I was in representing drug-free bodybuilding.
Okay. Well, I believe the contest with you and Ferrigno was the Mr. International contest. And I remember that because I remember seeing pictures back then I was able to see. And I remember seeing the pictures and he was huge and smooth as can be.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay, so what happened that your pro football career probably wasn't as long as you would have liked it to have been, I would guess?
No, not really. I mean, my pro football career, I wanted to prove to myself that I was good enough to play professional football. I never said I wanted to be all pro. I never said I wanted to make a living doing it. I wanted to accomplish that dream as a child, that I was good enough to play at Shea Stadium and be protecting Joe Namath and playing, with Winston Hill and other Don Maynard, who's in the Hall of Fame. And I did that. So it was like I wanted to teach school. That's what I went to college for. I wanted to be like Mr. Girosa, who was my seventh grade health education teacher. I wanted to be Mr. America. So me getting out of football, I had a knee operation, and I had a knee. They called me Superman when I played because nobody looked like me. And the Jets couldn't believe I was as fast as a running back, and I weighed 270 a minute. I was doing 40-yard dash times, like 270 pounds, running 4.6, 4.7, with full equipment on a grass field, was unheard of. I think probably only a few people on the Jets could beat me in a race. And even by today's standards, that was 1969, 68.
That's still a respectable time.
You're going to get at least a free agent contract today if you're 270, 6'1". Can dunk a basketball and can run a 4.6 40 with full equipment, you're going to get a tryout any place, any time. And that's how many years ago I was doing that. So, and that's because of bodybuilding and weight training and the proper nutrition, which nobody was doing. So I had a huge advantage because nobody was lifting weights. So here I am doing something that they say is going to make you muscle bound. And I said, gee, I'd like to be muscle-bound running 4.6 40 at 270 and at 6.1 dunking a basketball. I'd like to be a little more muscle-bound.
Absolutely. So basically it was you proved it, you were playing pro ball, and it was kind of next, now let's go on to being a teacher and changing some people's lives.
Yes, and that's correct. And then climbing the mountain to be Mr. America, right, which in 1970 I did.
Okay. You taught, what did you teach? You
were, I taught health education. It was not part of physical education. Health education in Hamden, Connecticut is a major subject. And without passing health education, you do not get a high school degree. So they did not let science teachers or phys ed teachers teach health. You had to have a health major to be able to teach. And I wanted a classroom, not a basketball. So I was a health education teacher teaching, the first sex education classes in the country and reproduction and respecting reproduction, part of sex ed, K through 12, and taught suicide prevention and substance abuse and teen pregnancy and AIDS and everything that kills kids and kills adults is what I taught kids to try to make more healthy decisions about. And as I've said to many people, God put me on this earth not to be a bodybuilder first or anything else. I mean, my profession, I have more respect for it. And I would trade everything I've ever achieved as an athlete. I would trade all of it to have been, if anybody said, okay, what's more important? Obviously, God, my family, first and second place, then teaching in third place, then sports later on after that.
Okay. And I'm sure you influenced and positively changed a lot of kids' lives. I'm sure you saw a lot of kids that reminded you of where you came from. And that had to just motivate you to really put a lot of love and effort into helping those kids.
You can imagine in 1999, I retired and my seniors cried along with me when I finally had the courage to tell them that I was going to retire because it wasn't something I wanted to do. We were involved in a contractual negotiations, and they were going to take, the school board was going to take our health benefits away upon retirement. And if I didn't retire, I was going to lose my health benefits, and it took me 6 months of agony trying to decide to retire or not. I did retire, but I was not a happy person for a long, long time. And I still look back. I mean, many of the dreams that I have are still that I'm teaching. Even today, that's how much it hurt me to leave the profession. But I still do a lot of school speaking on bullying and on self-esteem, and I do enjoy, whether it's elementary or high school or even college, where I do get asked to speak, I do really enjoy it, and I haven't lost a step when it comes to my ability to speak with people and have them listen to me.
I have no doubt that the kids really loved you and really related to you well, because you have this, in spite of the fact that you're this huge mountain of a man, strong and healthy and everything, you have this gentleness and this vulnerability, because you can still hear it in your voice that you still have some of that fat Jewish kid that doesn't fit in still in you.
Yeah, that's correct. And probably having to overcome has made me stronger and more resolute in reference to what my reason to be on this planet is for. I remember a quote, I think, in the book back in 1970, before the movie, was the book Pumping Iron. And I was always fearful of dying, you know, without, you know, like on my tombstone, that here lies, you know, my cats, you know, and here's the year you were born, and here's the year you died. And like there's nothing else, that you just kind of, being a good father and a good provider, that should be enough, you know, and that's a great tribute to a person that lives a life legally and pays their taxes and, you know, loves this country and brings up good kids. I mean, they're heroes that are unsung heroes. But back when I was young, I didn't think of those things that I would have 20 years later or 50 years later talking to you. I just needed more. My self-esteem was so low that I just needed to be more than just maybe the typical good father or good provider. And I just said, you know, when I die, I want to die with a smile on my face, that, you know, I did what I had to do, and I'm a good person, and I've done a lot of good things for a lot of people, and a lot of good people have done a lot of good things for me. And I will continue, like Bill Pearl, and Lee Haney and some of my heroes, who I think are the greatest people in the sport, I will forever emulate them, respect them, and try to lead the lives that they lead to my death.
Well, you're putting yourself in some good company with both of those gentlemen.
I sure am. Very lucky.
This has nothing to do with anything, but before I forget, a friend of mine, do you remember a competitor in Connecticut named Paul Santos?
Absolutely.
Super muscular.
Great body.
Okay, well, Paulie is a friend of mine, and I told him we were doing this interview today, and he said, "Mike Katz judged me. I can't tell you how many contests." Tell him Paul from Hartford Barbell Club said to say hi.
Oh, that's great. I wish him well, and I'm so happy he's doing well. A very good friend and great bodybuilder, and you talk about a hardcore gym where he trained. Man, that was Hartford Barbell. Yep. Remember it with a lot of love.
Those gyms are always the best. That's, you know, when I found out you were, you know, you owned Planet Fitnesses, I went, no, those aren't real gyms. How could you do that?
Well, the
it's business.
I understand what you're saying. And, you know, a lot of people have, you know, back years, a few years ago, kind of thought I sold out. And trust me, we were World Gym for, I don't know, 30 years. And it just got to a point where we just, you know, with the business model, with the insurance problems, and with other reasons, that kind of hardcore gym, we just couldn't make a living. And we either were going to make a move to get to a business model that could help. And again, you know, Planet Fitness, I don't have to really defend it, but just to explain to the listeners, you know, when you're retired from bodybuilding and you kind of left your ego at the door, and it's no longer time to lift and crash weights on the floor and kind of grunt and groan, you probably, many of you out there listening, will be at a stage where you want to go to a clean, healthy place that is safe and is well-run and is affordable, so that you could go train with your wife or your grandkids. And Planet Fitness is not hardcore, and it's not a lot of things that the old-time gyms were, but it's a thriving franchise that meets the needs of the majority of people who want to be fit. And the hardcore gyms don't do that. They're for football players and wrestlers and power lifters, and they have a place, sort of like CrossFit kind of place. They have a place in the choice that people can make. But today, you know, we've got my son and his daughters to put through college, Mike Jr., and, you know, he runs our clubs along with my partner, Jerry Mastrangelo. And that model is just the kind of model where you can make a living and pay your bills, and you could be welcome to all. In the old world gyms that we once had and the hardcore places of yesteryear, there's a few of them still around, but most of them can't even afford to be insured because of the injuries that are sustained within the walls of those heavy-duty places. So, you know, it was time to move on, and I loved my involvement with World Gym and Arnold and Joe Gold, who originated not only Gold's but World Gym. But, you know, I was at a point with my son and my partner to take a look at a different business plan, and I'm very proud of our Planet Fitnesses. We now are, if it was not for the NPC and in the IFBB, if we did not have the bikini division and the figure division and the fitness division, if we didn't have those divisions and women's physique, not women's bodybuilding, but the Corey Everson-looking body, which isn't bodybuilding anymore, if we didn't have those women who train at places like we own, Planet Fitnesses and LA Fitnesses and places that are more mainstream, I think what would happen is there wouldn't be any bodybuilding. Because you look at a big show today, there's 500 people in the show, 420 are women. And they're not bodybuilders.
No.
They're fitness and figure and bikini division women. And for 60 men bodybuilding, for somebody to put out $20,000 or $30,000 to run a show, you're not going to make it. So, you know, to kind of like defend Planet Fitness or LA or some of these other crunch gyms where a lot of the women train, we're serving our purpose from a competitor standpoint. Yes, we're not involved with Mr. Olympia's or... but, you know, it's interesting. We just had one of my boys, Abdul, from our Hamden Planet Fitness, just won Steve Weinberger and Beth Francis's. He just won the physique division in New Jersey last week. As a matter of fact, he won two divisions, and he trains at Planet Fitness. So now, even with bodybuilding, you've got the physique competitors, not the bodybuilding competitors, and these guys don't need to go to some hardcore, you know, gym like we used to run. So in defense of Planet Fitness and other more softer kinds of places, we do serve a huge purpose still in the competitive sport of quote-unquote bodybuilding.
Well, Mike, you don't need to defend it. It's a simple business matter. And the truth is, a hardcore muscle gym is a hard business to be in. There's not enough people to support it. And it's just gone. It's the era of those kind of facilities just aren't there anymore. And if somebody's serious about training, whether they're a marathon runner or a bodybuilder or a fitness or figure or a physique contestant, they can train anywhere. It's not the equipment you have at disposal. It's, you know, what's going on in your head and in your heart. So
yeah,
there's
right.
Nothing for you to defend there.
You have to be better. You know, you're not... Back in the day with the movie Pumping Iron, I mean, for you to walk in without, you know, showing a lot of your body which is necessary when you're looking in the mirror doing an exercise to be able to watch and concentrate on the muscles. I mean, that gym and my love of that gym and the World Gyms that we owned prior to the last, say, 11 years since we've changed to Planet Fitness, I will never, ever disrespect or not love or not feel compassion for my days of serious training. But, you know, I remember years ago, Bill, that when it was so hot in the YMCA in New Haven, I could not train. I mean, I would collapse. And I had friends that owned what was called a European health spa, which would have been similar to LA Fitness, and they had air conditioning. And I would say one or two times during the hot summer in Connecticut, I would, as a treat, go to, like, it was called European health spa. I would go there and I would wear, you know, a t-shirt instead of a tank top, and I would wear shorts instead of, you know, sort of the kind of shorts that you would wear to see your leg develop, and I would wear like a basketball shorts. So, I mean, I dressed appropriately. I didn't freak anybody out. But, I, you know, it's funny. I got good workouts in those air-conditioned places back in the day when they really didn't want you there, but I knew the owners, and I wasn't grunting and groaning. I wasn't spitting on the floor, swearing. I wasn't throwing chalk dust all over the place. I mean, I behaved, and I listened to the rules. And really, Planet Fitness doesn't want you to do anything other than that. They have what's called a lunk alarm, you know, and obviously, if you got a bunch of kids running around yelling and making people uncomfortable, you know, there's an alarm that goes off. And then a person comes and says, look, this behavior is not necessary, and it's not to the liking of what our rules are. So if you want to act like a normal human being instead of being a wild man, like in back in the day when we had our hardcore gyms, I mean, I remember Joe Gold, you know, he had rules, and there was no monkey business in Gold's gym or in World Gym. You know, you trained, and you trained hard, and you paid attention to the rules that we had. You don't drop weights. You're not screaming. You're not making people feel uncomfortable. It's just that those kind of gyms, there are some. I mean, CrossFit's got its little niche of people, and I wonder how they're not sued every day of the week for the kinds of things they're asking people to do in there. It's like insane. It's just a recipe to get hurt. But maybe the people that want that kind of special forces, Marine type of training, maybe they just don't sue anybody for people who possibly get hurt because it's not their fault, but it's the club's fault.
Mike, it's so funny that you went off into CrossFit because I was going to say we've been talking for close to an hour. And there's a few things I want to cover before we wrap it up. And one of the things was I wanted to know your opinion of CrossFit. And you already told me pretty much you're not a fan of it, obviously.
Well, no, it's not like I'm not a fan of it, because that would be a wrong interpretation of maybe what you thought I said or what I did say. No, I'm not against any form of exercising that can help people live their dream. So CrossFit would fit into a group of places that would accomplish what my philosophy is. The thing that I guess concerns me as a coach and an educator and a person that wants people to not get injured while they're training is it seems to me, and I may not understand the model well enough, that, and as, I guess as long as they continue to grow in popularity, then it's possible. What I interpret to be isn't in fact true. It's just, you know, taking a 300-pound tractor trailer tires, trying to lift them up however you can, and then throw them over on their side and then pick them up again. Sort of like the stuff that the world's strongest men do, which is very entertaining. And I understand how easy, because I know a lot of these guys, the world's strongest man, I think is from Colorado. And I was just in Rio with Arnold. I judged the Arnold Classic in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. And I spoke at length with, I think his name is Long, but he's this 6'8", 420-pound guy that takes a 300-pound dumbbell from the floor, and in a minute he does 8 repetitions with it from the floor to his shoulder, and then presses, one-arm press. It's just I see these guys, every time I see a World's Strongest Man competition, somebody gets hurt, has to be carried off the stage, rips a bicep, tears a pec. I think that, you know, if you want to do that, great. I mean, it's a free world, and if you want to try to compete in CrossFit or do these things, I just find it hard enough at times to teach people how to do things correctly so that they don't get injured in a controlled gym environment like Planet Fitness than to do some of these things with these deconditioned people, because I see them. We have a CrossFit near our Brantford location, and I see some pretty out of shape looking people running on the road. It's like, it's good for them, and hopefully they don't get hurt, and hopefully if they do, their insurance will cover their business. It's just not, for me, the kind of involvement, because our members are, many of them, deconditioned, first-time gym people who've never joined a gym before, I think 60%. And we have a lot of people who are over 40 and 50 years old. So for them to be doing CrossFit, it's not for them, the majority of them.
Okay.
So they have a group of people that they enjoy. Hopefully they do well with those people and they continue to keep them uninjured. And we're trying to do the same thing, but it's a different crowd of people. So I in no way are angry or mad or think that CrossFit isn't the right thing. It's the right thing for the right people. God bless them. I hope they do well. They're not. I don't consider them a competitor, because CrossFit attracts people that we don't attract. And Powerhouse Gym, they attract. They're not competitors. They attract the people who they attract. So it's like a different restaurant for a different clientele of people. And God bless everybody. I hope everybody
exactly
doesn't get hurt.
Okay. No, when I said you weren't a fan of it, I didn't mean on a personal level. I just meant their methodology is definitely not, it doesn't fit in my idea of a proper way to train novices and decondition people.
Okay.
And it's pretty obvious that's your feeling as well. Well, I think that pretty much covers everything I wanted to address with you. And could you just give me a parting comment, parting thoughts?
I'm happy I've had the opportunity to speak to your audience and enjoy it immensely that you, Bill, do such a great job in helping to keep alive the legends like myself and not let us roam too far out of people's consciousness. And it really, I'm flattered and honored and humbled by the opportunity to have this chance to talk to your audience. And if there's anything further or any time in the future you need any help at all, please let me know.
I really appreciate that, Mike. And this is Bill with Real World Fitness, and we've been talking for about the last hour with a true bodybuilding legend, NFL player, school teacher, father, family man, business owner, and all-around really great guy, Mike Katz. And we'll be back next week here on Real World Fitness with another great interview. Everybody have an awesome week. Real World Fitness is a production of the Serotalk Podcast Network in cooperation with KosiabaFitness.com. All questions, comments, and feedback should be submitted to resources@serotalk.com. If you're listening on a mobile device, use your iBlink radio app to submit an iReport. Promotional consideration paid for by Audible.com.